Welcome to episode 48 of Practical Defense. Occupy their space. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Addix. Our topic this week is something we call Occupy Their Space. But before we jump in, we'll first hear a tip from our partner, Kristen Beck, at kristensguide.com. Always explain to your kids where you'll be while you're apart from them. For example, Dad's going to the grocery store while you're at school today. That way, during an emergency, if they need to get a hold of you but can't, such as if your mobile phone was accidentally turned off, they can at least help the adults with them figure out where to reach you. Kristen's Guide offers more tips to help empower your kids and keep your family safe. And before we get into the main topic, I also wanted to talk a little bit about my website. I've had hundreds of thousands of downloads of the podcast, but only a few folks actually stop by the site. I'm working on my training schedule for the remainder of the year, and I'll be posting it by the end of the month. I'm going to run some shorter seminars, about 2 hours each, with a smaller fee. I've received some feedback that the full Jim Wagner all-day programs I've run in the past were too expensive for the way the economy is. I also have articles I've written on my site and a list of books and DVDs that I found to be informative and valuable in learning about self-defense. And I update these areas about once a month, so stop in occasionally and see the latest. There's also a store on the site where you can buy t-shirts. Now, these are the official reality-based system t-shirts with the Jim Wagner logo on them. And you can't even get these shirts on Jim's site. And finally, I wanted to say a word about Facebook. And quite a few listeners have found my page on Facebook, and I really appreciate all the friend requests, but I feel bad when someone asks to add me as a friend and I ask who they are. I'm always afraid I'm going to offend somebody. Now, I always challenge unknown friend requests, which is actually a good practice, by the way, because there are a lot of spam bots out there. Now, remember that once you add someone as a friend, they can see everything on your page, including your personal contact information. Blindly adding people might result in spammers and marketers getting your phone numbers, your physical address, your email address, and links, and whatever else you have posted on them. I've actually caught a few of these attempts in the past and managed to block them. So what I've done is create a fan page under my name in Facebook. And this is open to anyone and everyone, and you just click add to join. You won't have to wait for me to approve you. And I'll be posting information about the podcast, what I'm working on, links, there'll be a discussion board where you can post your own stuff and information and share things with other listeners. I'll include a link to the page in the show notes. And now, we'll be right back with our look at turning your defense into an offense. Surviving any crisis is arguably more mental than physical. From keeping your head when fleeing a burning building to the will to live when you're stranded out in the wilderness, or just doing what needs to be done in order to survive a physical attack, it starts and finishes with your mindset. Your attitude towards your own personal protection or the protection of someone you love is a huge factor in any outcome in a physical confrontation. I'm not talking about walking around with a chip on your shoulder looking for a fight. I'll cover attitudes in another episode. I'm talking about what you are willing to do. For example, I cover the absolute basics of handguns in my women's survival course. We don't use the real thing, we just use airsoft guns. Many of the women tell me, oh, I don't like guns, I would never use one. So, I ask, if you were being attacked by three men and a pistol was lying on the ground next to you, would you use it then? And often I get the answer of no. There's the line. What are you willing to do to protect yourself? Obviously, in these cases, they're unwilling to use the lethal force of a gun to defend themselves. It's not right or wrong. It's a personal decision, and I completely respect it. People all over the world are willing to put themselves in harm's way or even die for their beliefs. This is just another example. Now, when I ask, so if those same men were threatening your child, what would you do then? I have yet to hear anything other than that they would completely empty the clip into every single last one of those guys. Now with that, we start the handgun training so that in the event it ever came to it, they would at least know which end goes bang if they manage to pick up a gun on the ground during an assault. When you are being physically attacked and escape is impossible, you must get the person to stop. Now, notice how I say when escape is impossible. As an honest citizen defending yourself, your priority is escape. Now, of course, if you are defending someone else, such as a spouse or a child, escape may not be an option. Also, if you're in law enforcement, you may have a duty to subdue and apprehend this person. But for the most part, I focus this podcast on civilian defense. So from the perspective that escape is not an option, for whatever reason, you need to make this person stop attacking you. And I believe that the vast majority of people are nice. They don't want to hurt or intentionally cause pain to another person, or even complete strangers. The issue is that the criminal element, the outliers of society, do not have such inhibitions. Your attacker is not going to stop just because it's the right thing to do, or if you ask or even beg them to. You need to make them stop, and that's where your mindset comes into play. You need to change your mode of thinking in significant ways. First, you can't think defensively. If all you do is try to protect yourself from harm, the attack will continue until your defenses finally fail. What you need to do is turn your defense into an offense. You need to attack your attacker. And this isn't an easy thing to do. It takes effort and training. You need to move into your attacker. In reality-based, we call this method occupying their space. You need to push back against their assault. Let this person know that you are not a soft target and that will curl up and just give in. You need to stand up and attack back. You are not the one who started this chain of events, but you are going to see it come to an end. We teach this in reality-based, Krav Maga teaches this, and it's also a fundamental of American Kenpo. As you advance to the ranks, your defensive moves, such as blocks and parries and checks, start doubling as strikes in American Kenpo. For example, an inward block becomes a hammer fist across the jaw as it moves to intercept the punch. A check becomes a claw across the face as it moves onto the torso. You make your attacker pay for every strike thrown at you. Blocks just don't deflect the blow. You smack that arm with force. Also, after the initial step offline and deflection, all of the American Kenpo moves continually push into the attacker, keeping them off balance and forcing the attacker backwards. Now, in order to make this type of defense work, you must control your sense of personal space. You can always tell the students who have never studied self-defense before or even played contact sports when they first join the studio. They're unwilling and uncomfortable getting close to their partners. You know, grabs and holds are at maximum arm's length. Defensive moves are from a maximum distance to land the blows. You need to get over that in a defensive situation. Real fights are close. They're dirty, ugly, and nasty. The highly choreographed fights that are on TV are spread out there for the audience to see. They have no bearing on reality. I actually shocked a good friend of mine in a Red Cross first aid and CPR certification class. We were practicing the Heimlich maneuver, and he was the person in distress, and I was the rescuer. So I went over to him, put a bear hug on him, put my fist in his belly under his diaphragm, and gently squeezed in an upward motion. I could feel him stiffen up in shock when I got right on top of him. To me, we were practicing a technique, just like any in martial arts, so personal space violation never even entered my mind. To someone who never practiced contact sports, the sudden invasion of space was shocking. Now consider that example, but add to it the fact that I was a complete stranger and I was attacking him. The shock would have been quadrupled. The invasion of space compounded with the delivery of a strike or blow from a complete stranger could be completely overwhelming. It can paralyze people who haven't trained for it or been conditioned to it. Criminals know this and they use it to their advantage. Finally, and this might be the toughest aspect, you need to hurt your attacker. Now again, the average person on the street finds hurting another human or even animal deplorable. I'm a hunter, and I can't hurt animals. I know non-hunters find this hard to believe, but it's true. No hunter wants to cause pain to animals. The goal's a quick kill. It's what we train for and what we practice. When the shot is bad, you should see the rush to the animal to end the pain. A good friend of mine used to hunt birds, but the first time his shot was off and the bird flew to a place where he couldn't get to, he put up his gun and never hunted again. He couldn't take the thought of the animal in pain. I've seen men, experienced hunters, nearly come to tears when the animal escapes after a bad shot and can't be found because of how awful they feel. And personally, I will never force a shot. Unless I know it's going to take the animal in one, I won't do it. I'd rather go home empty than risk the suffering of the animal, and I've gone home empty-handed plenty of times. Also, just to be clear, I eat everything I hunt. If I won't eat it, I won't hunt it. I don't do trophies. Now, the military all over the world spends billions of dollars a year training soldiers to overcome this innate inhibition to causing pain in others. It's just how humans are wired. It's a reason that millions of people can get along in cities. Now, a great book on this subject is called On Killing by Colonel Dave Grossman. It's required reading in all the U.S. military academies and most of the officer candidate schools. Here's the thing. Violent criminals have no such moral restrictions against inflicting pain. And the real sickos even join hurting other people. Now, due to their socioeconomic environment or just how they're wired, many criminals only understand pain. Asking nicely, pleading, or begging won't end the attack. You need to tell them to stop, and that language is pain. You need to switch into a mode similar to theirs. You need to strike them hard and with appropriate force. They need to feel it. It needs to register. It needs to penetrate their consciousness, and they must realize that there's more from where that came from. Simple taps, play punches, or some of the wussy stuff thrown in the dojo won't send that message. The message you need to deliver is, stop attacking and stop now. You want this person to clearly understand that you're a hard target and that it was a bad idea to initiate this exchange, and it's in his or her best interest to quit now and run away. Think of it in these terms. What does pepper spray do? It inflicts pain and incapacitates. What does a taser do? It inflicts pain and incapacitates. You're doing essentially the same thing, but manually. The goal is the same. The result is the same. The only thing that's different is the tool being applied. At this point, I want to point everyone to episode 7 of Practical Defense, where I go over the use of force ladder. This is a guide to what you can do and should do in a confrontation. In most circumstances, you can only meet force with equal force. If you exceed that, you can get into some pretty hot water legally. I put that episode out early in the show series because I knew it would have relevance to many of the topics I'd cover. And this is one of those cases, so be certain to check it out. And if you've listened to it already, you might want to listen to it again as a refresher. Also remember that once they stop their attack upon you, once they're incapacitated, once they submit or run away, you are bound by law to cease your attack. The moment your attacker is incapacitated, you must stop, or you risk being seen as the aggressor in the eyes of the law. There's a story I was told many years ago. A man with the intent to rape physically assaulted a woman. She was a black belt, and she beat the holy hell out of him. He ended up barely conscious on the ground. She started to walk away when he moaned. She then went back over to him and broke his arm. Now, in the end, the woman went to jail, not the man who attempted to rape her. Why? She had incapacitated her attacker, and he was no longer a threat. She went over to him after the confrontation had concluded and broke his arm. The attack was out of pure maliciousness, not out of fear for her life or personal protection, and that is when she broke the law. If she had just walked away and called the police, she would have been on solid legal ground. Now, are there times when just submitting is safer than attacking? Absolutely. Nothing is ever 100%, and sometimes just curling up and taking some punishment will result in less overall damage than fighting back. Those instances are usually when you're facing overwhelming power, when you know striking back will have no short-term or long-term positive impact, when fighting back will just anger the person or persons more, resulting in a more severe beating, and you know that death or crippling injury won't result. How can you tell when that's the situation? There are far too many variables to even begin discussing them in this forum. You'll just have to go with your own experience and judgment. In simple terms, those situations just plain suck. But they are also reality, and they do happen. Now understand, though, that submitting is merely a short-term survival option. Often, your only long-term solution is to completely remove yourself from the environment that led to the situation to begin with. There are many, many free community and private outreach programs that help people out of circumstances just like that. Take advantage of them. Okay, here's a summary of some of the key concepts of turning your defense into an offense, also called occupying their space. You need to attack your attacker. A purely defensive posture will not end the attack. You need to overcome your sensitivity to personal space. Physical attacks are close and brutal. You need to learn to work effectively in close proximity to another person. You need to convince your attacker to stop. The most effective way to convince your attacker to stop is with the application of pain. Sometimes submitting is safer than attacking. Submission is only a short-term solution and only viable in a very narrow set of circumstances. You are legally bound to stop your physical defense once your attacker is incapacitated, submits, or runs away. All right, that does it for this episode of Practical Defense. And don't forget to check out my monthly column on TaekwondoTimes.com. It's called Raising Awareness. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe. Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions and commentary, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.